we get it underway this afternoon by talking about the big news that broke yesterday, and that is the passing of NBA legend Bill Russell, who died yesterday after a remarkable career and a remarkable life. And we thought to talk about him, we'd turn to somebody who was right there covering him. He's the author of the wonderful book Tall Men, Short Shorts, and a longtime sports writer, the great Lee Montville, joins us. Lee, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Rich.
Shocking news yesterday, although, you know, when a man is that age, I guess it shouldn't be shocking, but Bill Russell just seemed like such a force of nature. I guess there was a part of me that thought he would always be around.
Yeah, but it seems like the train is pulling out for a whole lot of people from that time. Johnny Egan, who was a great basketball player from Hartford, Connecticut, and played for the Lakers in the same series, he died like a week ago, and Tom Heinsohn certainly, and Casey Jones, Sam Jones. It's just what happens, isn't it?
Well, it sure is. Well, your book is so wonderful. We've talked with you about that, and one of your assignments in covering the finals back in 1969 was to make sure that player coach Bill Russell called in for a column for the Boston Globe. Can you talk a little bit about what that experience was like?
Yeah, well, I kind of invented the column. I was 25 years old covering the playoffs, the Celtics and the Lakers, and Bill Russell. And I was, you know, just new to the scene and very rough around the edges. And Bill Russell was 35 years old, his last season, you know, rich and famous, and he was the coach and the star player. And so our social situation was kind of different, you know? And I was always kind of like an annoying little guy on the side, I think, that just bothered him a little. But anyway, the papers back then, they all kind of went for a thing where they would have one of the players do a first-person story, an as-told-to story, after every game of the playoffs. And the Record American had John Havlicek, and the Herald American had Red Auerbach, and the Globe had nobody. And so I went to my boss, Ernie Roberts, and I said, you know, we should get somebody. And he said, well, everybody's taken. He said, who would we get? And I said, well, I think we should try Bill Russell. And he said, do you think he would do it? And it was clearly an idea that had come from nowhere, you know? And I said, let me go ask him. And I asked him, and I think it was like $200 a column. And he said, yeah, I'll do that, sure. And as far as I know, that was the only business thing. There was no handshake. There was no contract, no nothing. He said, sure, I'll do it. And somehow they must have got the $200 a column to him. And he wanted to do it by just calling up the Globe offices and talking into one of those old dictaphone machines that they had, like a blue plastic record that recorded his words. And so he would talk after each game into over the phone into the machine, and some kid from Northeastern would type it up, and it would be in the paper the next day. And my job, after every game, win or lose, was to say to Bill, don't forget to call the Globe. And it was kind of a precarious job after some of the losses. But I would just go, and Bill, don't forget to call the Globe. I was like a nagging wife or a mother or something, you know?
And as you pointed out in the book, Lee, the relationship was perhaps best described as distant. There were times when he would welcome you and have a great conversation, and then other times just pass by and not give you the time of day.
Yeah, about one time out of every five or six. It was a far different situation, you know. There wasn't a big media crush after these practices. I would be alone sometimes in the locker room, you know, with the Celtics and me. And so I'd kind of have to wait for Bill Russell every day because he was the coach, and you'd have to find out, you know, who was hurt and what was going on. I was a constant thorn in his side. But every once in a while, it would just be Bill and me, and I would ask him some question. I would not know where it came from that would whet his interest a little, and he would talk for a while, and we'd talk back and forth for 20 minutes. And I would go away saying, well, Bill is my friend now. We're in good, it's a great situation. And then the next day, I would say, hey, Bill, how are you? And he would walk right by me like he'd never seen me before in his life. Which is his prerogative, you know?
Well, and then in Game 7, Will McDonough asked you to go in and find out if Russell was going to retire.
Yeah. You know, Game 7 was crazy. It was a crazy ending. The Celtics win. It's at the L.A. Forum, the whole thing. There was a whole situation. They were going to drop a few thousand balloons to celebrate and all of that, and the balloons never dropped. And Wilt Chamberlain took himself out of the game, and there was just a bunch of things. And I'm standing outside, and Russell had the locker room door closed for quite a while after they won the game. And Will McDonough comes up to me, and I have a thousand different ideas going in my head. And McDonough says, you got to do me a favor. You have to go ask Russell if he's going to retire. And I said, well, why don't you go ask him? And he said, well, Russell hates me. He would never even talk to me. So I said, sure, I'll do that. So I had all these things, and I'm trying to put the story together, and I keep looking over at Russell, and I'm trying to get him all by himself. And he's going through the stages of taking off his uniform, coming back from the shower, putting on his clothes. And it's like at the end of the whole interview time, and he's standing there with Jim Brown, the football player and actor, you know? And he's just talking and finishing up, you know, tying his tie and stuff. And I say, I got to go ask him now. And I go over and you know, these are the two big, I would say, civil rights activists of the time, you know, and from an athletic standpoint, you know, they and perhaps Muhammad Ali, and, you know, proud black men. And I'm like 5'8" and a very white guy with red hair and freckles. And I go up to Bill and I say, when I get nervous, my voice kind of goes up a little bit. You probably heard this right here. And my voice goes up and I go, Bill, is there a chance you're going to retire now? And Jim Brown, you know, who's the movie star, he looks and he says in a much deeper voice, he says, retire? The man just won the world championship. Why would he think about retiring? And Bill just kind of nods to that. And I go, oh, okay, all right. And then I had to say to him at the end, I had to say one more thing. I had to say, don't forget to call the Globe. And he didn't. He'd called the Globe. And then he'd retired. He did retire. He retired about 2 months later and sold the story to Sports Illustrated for $10,000.
We're talking with Lee Monfield here on Downtown. Well, we know about Russell's basketball career, but his work on civil rights was certainly a hallmark of his life, and he didn't just talk the talk. As you point out in the book, he had attended the Summit for Black Athletes in Cleveland. He had run an integrated basketball camp in Mississippi and always had a challenging relationship with the city of Boston. I think in the book you quote him as calling Boston a flea market of racism.
Yeah, which is a pretty colorful term right there. He did have a tough relationship with Boston. I think he brought some of that on himself. I will say that because there were other African American players who played here and wound up living here and staying here, like Casey Jones and Satch Sanders, you know, and Sam Jones. They all went through without the problems that Bill Russell had. He was quoted in a Saturday Evening Post article, you know, saying, I just play for myself. I don't play for the city of Boston. I don't play for anybody else. I play for myself and my teammates and, you know, the heck with the city of Boston. And for sure, some bad things happened to him. Red Auerbach always had the philosophy of the bad apple. He would say, you know, if something happens to you, it's the bad apple who brought it around. You know, there's a million good apples out there. People who carry you off the court when you win these championships. But Bill Russell never bought the bad apple philosophy, or he kind of thought that there were a whole lot more bad apples than Red said.
Now, he was not Red Auerbach's first choice to take over as coach.
Yeah, there's like different stories about all of that. And I think it just kind of evolved to the idea that the best chance Celtics had for Bill Russell to play another season or three, as it turned out, was for someone that Bill Russell really liked to be the coach. And there's nobody that Bill Russell liked better than Bill Russell. So it kind of evolved that way. It wasn't, you know, and Russell and Red Auerbach, he was the first African-American coach of any team in professional sports, really, in the United States. And that wasn't one of the thoughts. The whole thought was, you know, Bill will play and Bill will be the coach and Bill will make himself play very hard. And it all worked out. It sure did.
Well, he's certainly the greatest winner in the history of American sports. He was a guy who focused more on defense and rebounding and wasn't always concerned with scoring. There were other people that could do that. Does that make it harder to figure out where his place in history ought to be?
I suppose. You know, I mean, he was the cerebral guy, and Wilt Chamberlain was the physical guy. You know, Wilt Chamberlain had all the physical attributes, and so Wilt was kind of Sparta, and Bill Russell was Athens. And he outthought Chamberlain. He figured out the geometry of the game and what he had to do to keep Wilt away and how he could help his teammates. And it is hard to quantify that, you know, especially in the age of analytics and all of that stuff. But I mean, I think your gut tells you if the guy has won all these 11 championships, he was pretty darn good.
Speaking of Chamberlain, they had a falling out after Russell's comments following that Game 7 in the 69 series. Was it 24 years that they didn't speak to each other? Did they patch it up at the end of Wilt's life?
Yes, they did. There was a nice ceremony for Bill Russell at the Garden, and Wilt came to that. They had patched it up. Russell went on a speaking tour after the series was over, and he was at the University of Wisconsin, and it was supposed to be no press and just talking with the kids. And of course, a reporter snuck in, and Russell said some nasty things about Wilt, about how Wilt took himself out of the game, and, you know, I'd have to be, you know, dead to be coming out of a game like that and stuff like that. And of course, the reporter put him in the paper, and the Associated Press picked it up, and it went across the country, and they didn't talk for 24 years.
Now,
they've been friendly. They've been friendly. They've been to each other's house for Christmas, for Thanksgivings, you know, for a bunch of stuff.
Now, did your relationship with Russell evolve over time?
Not really. You know, I mean, he was gone after that. He was gone.
Mm.
I did one story on him when he was the coach for a short time at Sacramento. I went out to Sacramento and I said, "How is this going to be?" And it's almost like I was a brand new guy and he was a brand new guy, and we just talked and, you know, glad to meet you. How are you? You know, it was a whole different arrangement at that time. So I never really saw much of him after that season. I just had that one little window, you know, where I had my self-interest was very big at the time. And that was our relationship.
Well, if you want to remember what Bill Russell was like in that last great season, that championship season of 1969, if you haven't already, read Lee's wonderful book, Tall Men, Short Shorts. Lee, thank you so much at short notice for coming on to talk with us this afternoon. We always appreciate it.
Thank you, Rich. Always good to do it.